Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Unpacking Peanuts, the show where three cartoonists go deep on the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz. I'm Jimmy Gownley. If you know me from anything, you might know me from my comic books, Amelia Rules, The Dumbest Idea Ever, or Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. And joining me, as always, are my two co-hosts. First, we have the composer behind the band Complicated People, as well as this very podcast, and the cartoonist behind such strips as Tangled River, A Gathering of Spells, and Strange Attractors, Mr. Michael Cohen.
Hello there.
And we also have with us former vice president of Archie Comics, executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
Well, guys, thank you so much, for joining me. It's so exciting to get into the first full year of Peanut Strips by Charles Schulz. You know, as we start out here, our hero is expanding his cast. He's focusing his themes. He's really beginning to master the daily comic strip format. Michael, why don't you get us up to speed? Where do we stand here January 1st, 1951 in the world of Peanuts?
Well, we're now 3 months into the strip, and Schulz is working with a very small cast, probably not very recognizable characters, and slowly getting his rhythms down and developing some of the themes which are going to be developing over the next few years. Because originally, it's very, very basic. There are four characters. We have Shermie. Probably, I'm guessing these kids grow up to be like four or five, very recognizable Schulz-type characters, large heads. Shermie seems to be a character without a whole lot of personality. He doesn't seem to have any really distinguishable characteristics. But the first strip is him and a little girl named Patty, probably around the same age. And it's not till the second strip that you see the character most associated with Peanuts, which is Charlie Brown. So you have these three kids, and you have a little puppy named Snoopy. At this point in the story, Snoopy is very much like a little dog. The character we know is still 4 or 5 years off, but it's really fascinating to watch the slow progression as Schulz gets a handle on these characters. Charlie Brown seems to be smaller or younger than the other two kids, and he's treated somewhat like he's the baby, the new kid in town, maybe. So just with these four characters, he's starting to develop this little world of Peanuts in which there are no adults ever appear. And at this point, no other characters than these four appear in 1950. So as we move into 1951, we're going to start seeing some new characters come in, and we're going to see some of these rather simple characters develop into the characters we know and love and really develop very, very distinct personalities. So I'd say at this point, Peanuts is still kind of in a very proto form. You can sort of recognize it, but it's definitely not the strip that most of us grew up reading and continue to love to this day.
Yeah, it's definitely an embryonic form. I'm sort of shocked by how many of the themes are present early. But the specifics, it takes a long time for him to work into those. So Harold, how about our hero, Charles M. Schulz? What's going on with him in 1951?
Well, it's a very big year for Charles Schulz. Like we said, he started the strip in October. He was living in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area with his father, who owned a barbershop. But during this time, he's also working at the art instruction schools as basically a cartooning instructor by mail. And he's around a lot of very talented, very ambitious people. And through some of those people, he meets a woman named Joyce Halverson and begins dating her. It's probably around the time that the strip begins. But fairly quickly, romance develops, and Charles Schulz proposes. And on April, I believe it's April 18th, 1951, Schulz and Halverson are married. That's a big, big deal for Charles Schulz. And they immediately go on a honeymoon to Colorado Springs, Colorado, and decide that they're going to stay there. And they move into a little suburban setting, actually, which is new for Schulz. He'd always kind of grown up around the urban areas of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but now he literally is in what we would see in the Peanut strip. It's kind of veterans housing, little small suburban tracts. And this is what Schulz is kind of showing in the strip, that he's now living in a little suburbia. And on top of this, Joyce does not come alone. Her daughter Meredith has been born earlier the previous year. And so now he has a baby child that he adopted the same time he gets married. So he's moved, he's married, and he's become a father, all in a period of a few weeks here in April, and living in a place he's never lived before. You know, certainly as a civilian, and he's now making a huge transition to a professional, full-time syndicated cartoonist, which was always his dream. And that's, you know, what I see in this strip in Schulz. If I were to call 1951 a particular kind of year, it would be, I'd call 1951 Charlie Brown a pretty good guy, because that character that we've got here is a guy, instead of being the put upon character, he's kind of the star of the show, and he's got a little bit of cockiness to him, and he enjoys life. He certainly can be disillusioned, as we are used to seeing Charlie Brown being. But this is a different Charlie Brown than what we see for pretty much the rest of the strip. And you can imagine, you know, Schulz is probably gaining a bit of a confidence here as somebody who was socially awkward in high school and hated being in the services as well, in armed service during World War II. He's kind of coming into his own here. And I think it's fascinating to see these strips at this time in his life, where he's really kind of, he's kind of celebrating himself in a way. I guess that's the best way I could put it when I'm reading these strips. That's what's kind of stands out to me. I don't know if you guys have the same feeling about that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see confidence when I look at these strips. You know, just from a cartooning point of view, his ink line is just gorgeous. And, you know, Peanuts is simply drawn, but that doesn't mean it's simple. And it's certainly not easy to draw that way, because there's no details to hide behind at all. It's just one confident line. I mean, this seems like a silly thing to say, but just drawing Charlie Brown's head correctly this phase is kind of a challenge. And it's not as expressive or as facile as his mature period, where it all really does feel like it's almost handwriting. It is really confident. There is just elements of fantastic cartoon drawing all throughout this year, I think.
Snoopy is darn cute in this 1951 year. I don't know how Schulz does this. I've never quite seen another character who is just, Snoopy just is. And Snoopy has got this little smile. It's like the Mona Lisa Snoopy 1951. I just find adorable.
Yeah, interestingly. Now, Michael, you said in our last episode, Snoopy is one of the things you wanted to track, his evolution, and you mentioned it today too. What were your takeaways of Snoopy's growth just in general over this year?
Oh, big year for Snoopy. He doesn't grow all that much, frankly, but Schulz definitely indicates that Snoopy knows a lot more than he gives on. I mean, Snoopy's sort of famous for what he's thinking and imagining and pretending. Here you see him as a dog, but he seems to be reacting to things around him. I mean, it looks like he might be able to read He even says something at one point, which, you know, Snoopy never really talks. It's just all thought balloons. But the evolution of this character is so slow. It's really amazing because if you look at Snoopy in these strips and then jump ahead 4 years and you see a little bit more recognizable dog who looks totally different. But if you look in between, you don't see the changes. You never see Schultz saying, well, you know, it's time to change Snoopy and make him, you know, make his head smaller and this and that. It's just, I don't even know if Schultz was aware of how he was evolving this character. But he's recognizably Snoopy.
Even well, I remember reading an interview with Schultz, you know, sometime in probably like the late 90s, where he said that he looks back at some of the periods of his drawings of Snoopy and he's appalled by it. And he specifically is talking about later in the 50s where Snoopy has sort of a long banana nose. It's for people who are familiar with that era, the strip, it's like the weed claustrophobia era of Snoopy. And so to me, that indicates that, yeah, he really wasn't consciously doing this. It was just the incremental changes of drawing the same thing every day. But just by nature, you're changing, your style is changing, your tools might be changing, everything contributes to the fact that these characters just evolve over time.
Yeah. And that's what we're keeping an eye on. As we go through 51, we're picking strips that we think are either important or extremely funny. But the importance would be, okay, this is a clue to where it's going. That maybe this is the first time that Schultz tried this gag, which would become like a major thing later on. So that's what I find interesting, is trying to get into his head and seeing that he's throwing all kinds of things at the wall. But when he really likes something, he doesn't forget it. And if it's really working, he'll bring it back and make it a major part of the strip. But it might take years.
Yeah. One of the influences I see in this year in that particular area, especially, is Crazy Cat, in that he is looking for his things, his situations that he can go to again and again and again and constantly, you know, wring new jokes out of them. But I don't see any visual. I'm not sure what the visual influences he would be looking at this time. I mean, it's still not the UPA animation style. I think that's still a couple years away. I mean, Harold, you might be able to speak more to that than I can, but it just does feel like a really unique visual world he's creating here.
I think that Schultz is really very, very simpatico with UPA. For those of you who don't know UPA, it was an animation studio that kind of came into its own around World War II. A lot of animators from Disney and other places came together, kind of a progressive view of cartooning in a more sophisticated line oriented style. It's very, very designy. You know, Disney in the animation world had moved toward realism that just awed people in the 30s and the early 40s. But by the late 40s and early 50s, UPA really caught the eye of a lot of people. And again, going back to Schultz being at the Art Institute, imagine what he is around, probably more so than he was for the rest of his life. He was going into an office with these very talented artists. I mean, this was originally a cartooning school and it became a general illustration school as well. But he's around some incredibly talented people, and they're very ambitious, and you know they're on top of what's going on in the field. And what is going on with UPA is they now are making cartoons on a regular basis and getting theatrical distribution for them through Columbia Pictures. So there's a lot of exposure to this new art style, and you're seeing its influences everywhere. You're already seeing it in some of the Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny type cartoons Chuck Jones was creating. But it's an amazing style, and what's interesting to me about Schultz's work is, in terms of the simplicity of line and design, there's no question that Schultz is going for it. I think if you had asked a UPA artist to look at Schultz's work at this point, I think they would feel simpatico, but they wouldn't necessarily feel Schultz is very sophisticated yet in terms of some of, you know, the line weights and this and that. But I do feel like he's very much in line with that. And I'm going to come back to this a little bit later, but I do feel like another way to look at this is EPA also introduced limited animation and ways of making limited animation, meaning basically low budget or not fully animated cartoons acceptable in the design world. And this was happening right before television came out. And so you needed to do things with super economy of line and movement. And you had to have simpler characters. And so what you're seeing here is, you know, I think UPA made quality limited animation possible in the era when television needed to be done cheaply and quickly. And that was kind of the downside of UPA. People look at it as like, oh, well, you know, we used to have beautiful Disney style animation. It's not UPA's fault. They just made it more palatable because there was so little movement in these lower budget things. I would argue that Peanuts is the equivalent of limited animation in the comic strips. It's a smaller size. It's shrunk down to such minimalism by necessity because it was sold as a space-saving strip when there were newsprint shortages. And so in the same way, Schultz took something that could have been a limitation and basically did marvels with this incredibly small space that required a very, very defined stylistic choices because he had no room to work in. Every line counts. And that's definitely a UPA thing.
Yeah, for sure. You know, there's a book that came out last year, The Strange Death of Alex Raymond by Dave Sim, who did Cerebus. And he talks about, it's mostly about photorealism in comics, which would be strips like, you know, Rip Kirby, Heart of Julia Jones, Mary Perkins on stage, and how Peanuts arriving just kills them, essentially at the height of their popularity, because, you know, there was a lot of effort put into those strips in terms of trying to get them to reproduce right, even though they never really did reproduce right. And Schultz was able to build this language where it didn't matter if it was printed on a potato, you would still be able to feel like you had a meaningful interaction with this strip, where, you know, these highly illustrative strips sometimes would get reduced down to just being a blob of nothing. So it's interesting because on the one hand, Schultz is the pinnacle of these of comic strips and the pinnacle of the form. But in another way, it really closes off an entire avenue of expression for a different type of artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But one thing that he was concerned with was the setting. And because it seems to me that a lot of the kids strips, you know, going back to the 20s, 30s and 40s, really tried to picture the urban landscape. I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, people growing up in poverty, living in a slum somewhere. And as Jimmy mentioned, you know, he had moved to a suburban tract in Colorado, and that's pretty barren. I mean, it's not a desert, but those suburban tracts are just, you know, newly laid pavement and a tree planted here and there and a lawn. And so there isn't much visual stimulus. And he's able to show that as just, you know, two parallel lines, right, as the curb. And there's really no backgrounds because there probably wasn't any.
Right. Before. Right. That is very true. And, you know, on a really crowded newspaper page, something minimal with a lot of white space is going to jump out at you. And, you know, it wasn't always on the comics page. So that was going to be important for him, too. So it didn't look like just another coupon or another ad for something. The negative space, the minimalism of the line, I think does make it jump out when you're competing with a whole lot of gray noise.
Yeah. Well, what's really strange, though, is, I mean, it's clearly a kid's strip. And kids are probably going to be more attracted to this very simple style and very simple characters. And it's very easy to tell who's who and what's going on. But Schultz was not aiming the strip at kids. That's the real strange thing. It looks like it's going to be, you know, funny, you know, pratfalls and pranks. And I wrote down a few words that he uses in 1951. Here's, okay, we have retroactive, filibuster, maladjusted, inhibited. He uses Beethoven, because I remember I read these, you know, pretty much around the time they were coming out a few years later. You know, who's Beethoven? I had no idea. I mean, there's plenty here that a kid would not understand, which I think has a lot to do with its success, because adults could read this easily.
Yeah, it's the trick is that he was able to write for a general audience without pandering to anybody. And, you know, I read these, you know, Beethoven. I didn't know why Charlie Brown was always saying Sigga. What the hell is that? Every time something bad happens, he looks at the camera and says Sigga. but it didn't sort of bother me that there were parts of it I didn't get. I wanted to get it. I wanted to reach for it. Maybe not all of it, but some of it, you know? And I even wanted to incorporate that kind of language into my personality almost, you know? It was a sophistication that was still really welcoming. It wasn't punishing you for not knowing. It was just very naturalistic to these characters.
Yeah. And that, I think we've talked about things like this before, where, you know, as a kid, when you're growing up, you're used to being exposed to all sorts of things you don't understand. And you're plugged into this world where you expect you're going to understand 30 or 40% of what's going on. And, you know, Peanuts also being a newspaper strip, which was really genuinely something that newspapers were trying to appeal to the whole family. This is a unique time in entertainment where, you know, the thing that does appeal to that broader audience, there's really an opportunity to create for more than one group within an audience and try to synthesize them. And I think Schultz was very much into that. One of the things that really struck me, I thought was kind of funny, was, you know, when they were trying to promote this, you know, what is this strip? And the very first time they were like putting out ads to send to newspapers who were signing up for Peanuts, I just wrote down some of the things that the syndicate, I don't know if Schultz had anything to do with this or not, but the way they described it is so nondescript. It's like nuggets of humor to enrich your daily reading was one of them.
Oh, man.
Another one said, isn't that wild? The greatest little sensation since Tom Thumb.
I've seen that ad.
From Schultz. For kids young and old, I can buy that. A kid's strip for everybody. A delightfully different kind of comic strip. Everybody will love this new comic strip. Small kidding in a big way. It's kids and kidding from that special little world of the small fry. Watch for this whimsical, heartwarming new strip. The whole family will enjoy the daily activities of our youngest comic strip citizens.
Yeah, I mean, they don't even mention character names because Schultz really didn't have characters like we talked about last episode. You know, it's just they're just really selling it on the strip is small and the characters in it are also small.
Yeah, and that in a way that totally frees him up, I think, to do whatever he's going to do. Because the expectations must be so low going into what this is and what it's supposed to be. But yeah, I mean, Schultz did use the word sophistication when he was saying, I was trying to do something new. You know, he was seeing that he was on a cutting edge of sorts in his own mind.
Or he wanted to subvert that whole advertising campaign by saying, oh, you want heartwarming, huh? I'll show you heartwarming.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting about the art style, I would say, and contrasting it with those soap opera strips, is that those soap opera strips were supposed to be the sophisticated things, right? Because they're like looking at fashion illustration, it's adult characters and serious stories. And Peanuts lays waste to that in that way, too. Because even though it is about these little cartoon characters with the giant heads, it gets to things that nobody was talking about in comic strips. And you know, it would be absurd to have Rip Kirby, you know, thinking about, you know, the existential questions of life like Charlie Brown can. There's something about the simplicity of the cartooning that allows the sophistication of the thought to kind of come through, I think.
Yeah, it does seem like, I mean, I was reading through these strips, I was struck the whole year was, in many ways, the humor is quite basic. I don't know if that's a fair way to put it. And if I were to be uncharitable, I might even say bland. There's the humor is, it's odd. It's like, it's almost like there's I have this odd sense of there's an innocence and naivety in Schultz himself as a guy who socially was just, you know, not somebody who he really grew into himself over the years. And I see comedy in here that is Schultz growing quickly as a person and as a humorist. But, you know, some of his stuff is kind of, I mean, it's like the non-joke joke that looks like he really thinks it's a joke, but it's not a joke. And I may not being charitable to him, but at certain times I'm like, there's really no there on a particular strip here and there, but he's constantly experimenting and it's super admirable. But there are a lot of jokes to me that just do not work.
Well, I kind of break these down into two categories. Because there are jokes, you know, fair jokes and great jokes in this year's strips, but a lot of the jokes are just jokes. In other words, it wouldn't matter who said them.
Right.
You know, there's a punchline. It could have been Shermie. It could have been Patty. The great strips, and I tried to select a few of these to demonstrate, and are the strips where if Charlie Brown says something, it says something about him, and it wouldn't work at all for any other character. And I think that's where he's heading, that these characters become so distinctive that they, you sort of know what's in their head when they say something. And you can almost anticipate what they're thinking. And so there's a few where clearly this is a Charlie Brown joke. It would not work for anyone else. The Shermie and Patty characters who we met in 1950 and are characters who I don't think we ever really get in their heads. And Schultz probably realized that after a while because they eventually kind of get shoved off to the side when he finds stronger characters like Lucy and Linus. There's no need for a Patty character. And you see Patty throughout the rest of the strip, but when there's a bunch of kids waiting in line to see a movie or something, I think he realized he can only go so far with her. And Shermie never really had much going anyway.
Right. Poor Shermie.
Yeah.
Hey, so before we go on, I do want to talk a little bit about something we discussed last episode that I have a little more information on. So we were wondering about what was this the first thing Schultz sent out to the syndicates? Had he tried a bunch of other strips and failed? And basically, from what I understand is, once he was able to sell Little Folks into the local paper, that was his focus. And his focus was to try to not just become a cartoonist, but to get Little Folks syndicated nationally. And he was even in negotiations with, hold on, I have it written down here, something. The Newspaper Enterprise Association, where he would be an independent contractor providing them with Little Folks to be syndicated, throughout the country. And that's why the local paper was holding on to it. Once that deal fell through, the newspaper then dropped the strip, you know, from appearing locally. And then his first batch of strips that he sent off to United Features was one pack. Well, he actually took the train to the offices to pitch these. It was one pack of strips that was in the Little Folks style, which was essentially gag strips, and then another patch, which was his first attempt at turning Little Folks into a four-panel strip, which is obviously what they bought. So,
one thing I also read was that prior to that, that was the first time he sent something to New York, but for at least a number of months, he was traveling to Chicago, where the Chicago Tribune syndicate, there were a couple of syndicates out of Chicago. And the story is that he went every so often pitching strip ideas. Given that he was going to the same places, I'm assuming there was some other content he was developing and trying to sell, although he must have clearly known that the thing that was really resonating were those Saturday Evening Post cartoons with the little kids.
All right, so that's a little more background on Schultz and where he was at when he was trying to pitch this strip. So how about you guys, we take a break now, and we come back and we discuss the strips of 1951 in detail.
Sounds good.
Great.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz, produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening, you blockhead!